So thank you so much for attending this session. I must say that I want to very much thank Dr. Jane Schwebke and Lisa Manhart, and also Larissa Wilcox, who actually did all the analysis and sitting in the room here today. So yeah, we're going to talk about chlamydia trachomatis. I'm probably preaching to the choir. Everybody knows this, but it's the most commonly reported bacterial infection or infectious disease. 1.4 million cases were reported in 2012. It's a cause of serious pelvic inflammatory disease, ectopic pregnancy, and infertility. Prevalence among men actually has decreased over the last 10 years, but yet the repeat infection rate is still remaining the same at about 11%, which is really very quite high. So you've seen this. If you went to the plenary session today, you saw the change. We're seeing many more cases of chlamydia than we've ever seen before. The rates actually in the subset of 14 to 19-year-old women has remained the same. And so we wanted to know, maybe is reinfection rate driving this? But what we don't know about that, but what we do know is the reinfection rate is a problem. It's the thing that causes most of the sequelae. So we used to treat chlamydia with doxycycline, and then several years back, maybe about 10 years ago, azithromycin came on the forefront. People were very excited about azithromycin because it had a lot of benefits, and one of the most important benefit is adherence. You could give it to the population in a single dose. It could be directly observed, and that was great. The pricing was significantly lower, and also there were many fewer drug interactions than what was known for doxycycline. So enthusiasm was quite high for azithromycin. And the original trials that were done by Walt Stamm and others really found a pretty good efficacy rate. So subsequent to that, over the last couple of years, enthusiasm is dampening a bit. And we're seeing that in just about every infectious disease, the common theme, and we're seeing emergence of resistance. So what we know that there have been several large randomized studies that are or large studies that have been out there that have demonstrated wide variations. And we don't know if they're geographical differences or if it's actually methodological issues or is it really resistance or what is it? So these three studies that I'm going to talk about are the one from Schwebke, the one from Manhart, Kissinger, and then there was actually, which is our group, and then actually Kong is not it was a meta-analysis that was done. So you can see there's a very large variation. From Schwebke, the original analysis, that was about 22%. When Dr. Sinha redid the analysis, it went a little bit lower after they accommodated for sexual re-exposure. Manhart, Kissinger, all seen wide ranges. So we need to know what's going on here. So the Kong meta-analysis actually evaluated 23 studies. And doxycycline was found to confer about 3% greater efficacy compared to azithromycin. What they found is the general treatment failure in these studies was about 6%. That group admitted that the meta-analyses are only as good as the inputs. And in several of the studies, they were either too small, single-centered, or non-randomized. And so they also suggested that maybe perhaps reanalyses of some of the larger studies taking into account some of the confounds that could happen might be of benefit. So the major confounders that we are considered here was early nucleic acid amplification technique testing. So what we do know that sometimes you can't just test people right after they're treated because there's remnant DNA amplicons there, and so you have to accommodate for that. So the studies, there are two studies out there. One said for sure you can't do it before 2 weeks because you're going to probably find about 30 to 40% of that is going to be false positive. The second study found that even after 3 weeks, you might still see about a 14%. But we figured at three weeks, probably by that time, the majority of DNA should have cleared. So we wanted to get rid of that confound in the study. The second confound is sexual exposure. And we know from several studies that sexual exposure can attribute or can account for as much as 30 to 60% of repeat infection rates, even in a short time period. So at test of cure, which was we tried to make it as close as possible. So there's a dance, like I don't want to have it too close because then the NAT test is going to be a false positive, but I don't want to have it too far out because it allows them to go ahead and have sexual re-exposure. And then the other methodological issue that we considered here is when a provider asks a question, first, if you counsel the patient to not have sex, and then they come back and you ask them if they've had sex, there's a little bit of a tendency to have social desirability bias there. So usually computer-assisted techniques are the best practices. So the purpose of this study was to take these larger studies, re-examine them, getting rid of those specific confounds. So data from these four, from men in four U.S. cities who received 1 gram of azithromycin. So the other studies were randomized trials, but we only considered the azithromycin arm. So they were given this 1 gram of azithromycin under directly observed therapy, and they were treated for uncomplicated chlamydial infections. They were asked to come back at base. They were at baseline and tested cure. They were given the nucleic acid amplification techniques, and in 3 out of the 4 cities, they were administered a computer survey. In the 4th city, they were provider interview. So this just gives you a comparison of the methodologies. They were basically pretty much the same. All the men had urethritis. They were done in various time frames, but within the last 7 years. The average time to the test of cure visit ranged anywhere between 15 days all the way up to 43 days. Everybody used nucleic acid amplification techniques, and as I mentioned, everybody 3 out of the 4 used CASI. One in Seattle, they actually also used sexual diary, but we only used the information from CASI. So data analysis, when we compared bisexual exposure, we also compared for men who were tested before 3 weeks and after 3 weeks, and we also examined people who were given just the CASI or people who compared to the whole group that also included provider. We used SAS for analysis. And simple chi-squares and Fisher's exact tests were done. So this is really our big table, and I'm just going to walk you through it because it's really busy, but the most important thing here is that when you look at the crude rates, it was 8.3%, which is much lower. If you look at the site-specific rates, they vary quite greatly. If you look at the stratified analysis, here is for those who admitted to have sexual exposure, and that was a 10.3% treatment failure rate, or repeat infection rate, I should say. We're not really sure. And among those who denied sexual exposure, was a 6.6. So far different and much closer to the meta-analysis. When we looked just comparing the different rates as well. So after removing sexual re-exposure, it was 6.6, as I mentioned before. And then when we took out the one site that used provider interview and also tested earlier than 3 weeks, it actually went down to 5.7. If you take this into consideration, if you're just looking at examining a crude rate, the repeat infection rate that could be attributed to sexual exposure or re-exposure, because people had either new partners or baseline partners, could be as high as 36%, which corroborates a lot of other studies. And also, if you look, considering the social desirability bias that could happen as a result of interviewing patients rather than allowing them to have more computerized or less possibly charged interview modality, that accounted for about 14% of the increased infection rate. So should we care about a 6% treatment rate at this point? There's a lot, gonorrhea is way higher, and so should we care? Well, the reason we probably should care is there was a modeling study that was done by Reagan et al. In 2013, and they said for every 1% increase in treatment failure, you would result in a 0.16 increase in baseline prevalence. So if you calculate that, that would mean that if you use doxycycline, it's about a 97% cure rate. If you use azithromycin, maybe more like a 94% cure rate. You may have another 97,000 cases per year, and that's pretty crude analysis. I think I can refine that analysis, but that 97,000 cases in the United States alone per year, that's attributed to that. So it may be important. So the strengths and limitations of the study was multi-centered, and it's very difficult to do these studies, very time-consuming. These were NIH-funded studies and STD-CTG-funded studies. So it's very hard to get a group of people that have actually organism and then follow them through. So it was, I think that was definitely an advantage of this study. Our power, even though despite having all these studies together, our power was indeed low, and I haven't actually done a power analysis, but I'm sure it's really quite low. And then susceptibility testing was not available. Susceptibility testing for chlamydia is very difficult, and so it's time-consuming and costly, and so that was not done. So I also think that future studies should probably be done with larger studies, if there could be like a GISP type thing or some place where we could gather more and more of these samples and actually look at them. That would be helpful to look and see, because there may be some regional differences. Seattle was so much higher than Jackson, Mississippi, and New Orleans. There may be something regional there, like maybe more usage of azithromycin or something. So in conclusion, future studies of treatment failure should consider the potential confounds of an early test of cure treatment. You should make sure that it's done no sooner than 3 weeks, And if you get too far out, then you're going to have more issues with sexual exposure. But no matter what, these studies should all consider sexual exposure, even though most people don't believe the patient when they say, I didn't have sexual exposure. If you can use some techniques like sexual diaries or something where a person doesn't have to admit it to the provider, it might be more useful. And the interviewing bias, as I just mentioned. So treatment failure rate for azithromycin, 1 gram for chlamydia, is probably around 6%. It's really, and Will Geisler just came out with a study in women, a very small study, but he found almost the same thing. He found a 7% treatment failure rate. So it seems like we're seeing a theme of that. It's not 22%, but 6 is still important. And that given it, that chlamydia is so common and the sequelae are severe, this rate is, in fact, unacceptable. And so I think that, and I think most people would agree, that better treatment options are available. Thank you very much. I forgot to say thank you to all my many collaborators. It was very kind and generous of them to offer their data to allow us, Larissa to do the analysis, which she did for her master's thesis, and also to NIAID for funding most of the studies. Now I can say thank you.
Dr. Patton. While Michael is going to them, I'll just comment that I love this study. I have some interest, skin in the game, since I editorialized about this at the Gaines paper and have a lot of interest in it. I would point out that you don't have women, and when we start looking at women, what people have not been doing consistently now, unlike a lot of gonorrhea studies, I don't think we have a clue how many women with cervical chlamydia also have rectal infection, and the rectum may be more of a problem in this arena than
great point.
Great talk, Dr. Totten. So two things is that one is the issue of whether or not you looked at people with prior chlamydia infection. So if they've had repeated prior treatment with azithromycin, is any of that data available regarding predictors of treatment failures?
That's an excellent question. I don't know. Do you know in your data set, was it?
No,
I don't think so. I know in our data set, which is the majority of the sample, was actually from Jackson and New Orleans, and I know we didn't have that.
Okay.
I mean, we had their self-report of if they had ever been tested, ever been treated for chlamydia, so I guess you could go with that.
Dr. Papp had his hand up.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I just had one comment about the azithromycin susceptibility testing.
Yeah.
There really aren't any in vitro standardized tests for azithromycin and chlamydia, so I think setting up something like GISP or KISP or whatever you want to call it.
I never know what to say.
would be almost impossible at this stage.
Okay. Thank
you. I know that Walt did a lot of work and Bob Suckland, and again, those tests aren't standardized. We at CDC had tried to do that back in early 2000, 2001, I think, and it just wasn't going to go anywhere.
Is there a genetic marker for it?
No.
Like you have for MD?
You know, it's interesting about the genetic marker. There's a laboratory up in New Jersey who thinks that they have a genetic marker, but it's just not.
It's not there yet.
It doesn't correlate. Mm. So. It's interesting. You could have talked about rectal infections and Roger Rank's stuff.
Oh yeah, you know. I don't have rectal here, or cervical. There are no women in the study.
So I wonder if by taking out the people who reported that they had sexual exposure, if you could have introduced bias because. But were they symptomatic? Because if people might be more likely to report that they had sexual exposure if they had symptoms, right? So you'd be removing them from the cases.
I think they were almost all, not all, but the lion's share of them were symptomatic because they were coming into an STD clinic for NGU. Some of them were contacts of a chlamydia-positive person, but they all had organism confirmed. So, I guess we should probably look at symptomatology as well. We have that. But that's a good point.
I would editorialize, if I could, for just a second, that that 6% is a lot better than 20%, and I'm more relaxed about this than I was 2 or 3 years ago. Still, as you say, not ideal. I'm curious, show of hands. You've got your 20-year-old daughter. You've got someone close to you who you know is going to be reliable. I'd like to see who's going to give her doxycycline first, and then who's going to give her azithromycin. Doxy? Anybody going to prefer doxycycline than that person? Interesting. I would. Azithromycin, you still mostly would prefer? Okay, interesting.
I mean, I think if you do azithromycin, then you make sure that they come back for it.
Well, that's the
other
thing.
Test of cure is not really recommended, but if you could have them get a retest.
I think SCD program has been reticent to add procedures that will increase cost. But on the other hand, test of cure can be accomplished by swinging through, dropping your urine, and leaving. So it doesn't have to be expensive. Let's take the one more question.
So I have, again, more of a general question. Do we know, and I'm sure you know, the drug distribution of azithromycin in the body? Are we sure that we don't have people with enormous body mass that are not getting enough drug? And I don't recall enough about azithromycin distribution to sort that out in my head.
I'm going to turf that over to Hunter because I don't know about that.
It appears not to be a critical issue up through the body sizes that were studied in terms of preclinical work by Pfizer years ago, but I'm not sure that they studied morbidly obese individuals.
It's a good point because we're talking about the South. Most of these studies, except Seattle, were in the South, and so there is issues with that. Thank you very much.